Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, where this time the artist-farmer Lisa Fingleton introduces us to the square tomato and other portents of the end times. We enter the Third Kingdom and a mushroom-based restaurant in New York, and Paddy Woodworth leafs through another volume set for the Naturalist bookshelf. But that's not all. Colin Tobin will be along later to explain a new little part of the Culture File Borg that we've gone ahead and called the Comfort Zone. More about that presently. But first, Lisa Fingleton's new show, The Square Tomato at Shimsha Tira, gathers evidence of the unconventional artist's work in fields and neighbouring farms, as well as in drawings and videos of a practice that's happiest outdoors, exploring farming and foodways, including the lore of that fruit that gives the exhibition its title.
This is where we're at. Bantaman hanging in the sky. Clean the windows.
A square tomato is something I hope never to meet in my life. But when I was in India recently, I was at the farm of Dr. Vandana Shiva, and her sister was telling us about going to a conference one day, and this man was talking about the square tomato and how they were going to make this amazing square tomato. And she politely put up her hand and said, "But everybody knows tomatoes are round." And he said, "But in one generation, they will forget that tomatoes were round." And I just thought that story was amazing in terms of how quickly we forget what was normal.
For him, that was aspirational that people would have forgotten.
Yeah, and I suppose this has been around for a while, apparently, in terms of the square tomato. But I hadn't heard about it before. And I just thought, gosh, that kind of says it all, doesn't really, in terms of manipulating what we regard as normal and it becoming something else. And then in a generation, we forget that that was not the normal way things were. So I just thought it was an interesting analogy for life, really.
And in that future, your drawing of a square tomato will be the thing that exists, and then there'll be all these strange round things that people don't recognise.
I know.
So tell us a little bit more about Vandana Shiva. For people who don't know her, tell us about who she is.
So Vandana Shiva is very passionate about food and about farmers, and particularly small farmers who maybe don't have anyone to advocate for them. And she's looking at things like GMO around the world and how it destroys livelihood for farmers, genetically modified seeds, and how when things like that are introduced into countries, farmers tend to get more in debt because they used to be able to save their seeds and now they can't save their seeds anymore because they're genetically modified and often sterile. So she looks to create movements of people around the world to say food is really important. It's something that everybody has to do. We all have to eat, and that we really need to protect our food systems. And we need to make sure that farmers are able to save seed, that communities are able to save seed, and that we use the heirloom seeds that we have and the traditional seeds that we have for the future, really, for future generations. But she also, she's a global activist. She advises governments. She also has a farm called Navdanya in India, where on 60 acres, they grow 750 varieties of rice. They have a living seed bank where they save all these incredible seeds. And it's just quite magic. I suppose, in summary, she's a global activist with a very local activism as well.
And we need the farmers, we need the eaters. We need the biodiversity. We need the cows, you know. Yeah. We're in an interesting little position. We're absolutely insane people with limitless greed and limitless power want to rule the world. And if we realize that we can govern ourselves through ethical considerations and a deep relationship with each other and with the earth, we are at a moment of the need, the imperative to reinvent democracy. That's why I've talked about earth democracy. Our democracy today will not come for humans alone. Our democracy of today will come through the earth for humans.
I've always admired her work, and I always thought I'd love to visit her farm because it's a place that Navdanya just sounds amazing. I think when you go somewhere like Navdanya, it's hard to explain the energy. It was one of the most beautiful, calm places I've ever been. And the seed bank, I mean, you walk into the seed bank and it's just like the most magical place. It's so quiet and there are all these seeds hanging. And some people might say, look, at what is energy? How can you feel energy? But I'm telling you, there is something in that place of all these millions of seeds that is just really impossible to describe, except that you feel you're surrounded by the abundance and magic of life. It's beautiful.
Voices from the field. I'm going to have the have Daniel playing here on a projector, some images on the wall. Images on the wall, we haven't hung them yet. And then you come out here and we'll be ending with a vinyl Power Lines for Peace and possibly some images.
So the Square Tomato exhibition came about from, the title came from my trip to India and the work with Vandana Shiva and her sister Meera. And then the work is an accumulation of work mainly over the last 2 years. So it's partly work that I made with farmers in Dingle on a creative climate action project, and also more recently with the community here in Ballybunion. So looking at how do we grow food, be creative and protect nature at the same time. That's kind of our theme here. So there's work from that. And then there's also work inspired by my time as artist in residence with Kerry County Council. So I'm the Kerry artist in residence. And I work a lot with young people and with children. And I feel that there's a real anxiety among this generation, this new generation, about their future. And I do feel a responsibility as an adult with, you know, environmental concerns to speak about that and to try and encourage people to really think about what we are doing to the planet and what we can do to salvage what we have so that the future for the next generation is not bleak and is a good future for them to live in. So like all those things come together, I suppose, Luke, to make the exhibition. So the exhibition is a combination of a few different things. There's lots of drawings. Some of them are from India, from Navdanya, and from the conversations I've been having with people.
The drawings are from, they range from kind of straightforward cartoons to these great big sort of ecosystems drawn as though they were like a system of cartoon happenings. The use of that style of presentation.
You know, it's really funny. Like when I was a child, I was always drawing. And then I went to art college and then I went away from drawing for a while. And when I came back, I thought, oh, I want to draw like other people. You know, I want to draw in a completely different way. And I still feel I draw the same as I did when I was a child. And yet it's really, and I've judged that sometimes, and I'm like, oh, I wish I could do different things. But the reality is I actually can do different things, but it's not me. And what was really interesting coming back to drawing, particularly in the last couple of years, is how they resonate with people. You know, sometimes the simpler the drawing, the more reaction it will get. So there's one drawing that is of a little child in a spacesuit, and he's basically, you know, or he or she is or there's a child in a spacesuit and they are having their lunch, which is a vial, a vitamin vial. And the child is saying to a parent, you know, do children really eat food grown in dirt? Now, I don't know where that came out of, why I thought of that. But I know when I show it to children, they think that's really funny, first of all. And then they're like, really? In 2050, we won't know that we ate food grown in dirt. And even already, a lot of the food that we're eating is very ultra processed. So it's really hard to explain to you how drawings come, because that's the magic of art, isn't it? I could be sitting somewhere and next thing there's a drawing fully formed in my head and I just have to get it down. And I think for me, that is the gift of the drawings, is that I can have these big complex things in my head. And sometimes then when I draw them, other people can see what's inside my mind. And I feel that with carnivorous capitalism, like I've been so upset about some of the rhetoric around refugees and asylum seekers. And I wanted to try and put that in a context of our extractivist mindset that has led to that, you know, the extractivism of colonial powers, taking everything from countries, forcing people into boats to cross the Mediterranean or whatever other sea and take that dangerous journey, and then to be met with, you're not welcome. After all that, I find that just unbearable. And to be able to draw that into a drawing just makes me feel better.
I suppose it's always true that an exhibition is always just a part of what's going on with an artist. But for you, the sort of ongoing projects are maybe as important as what shows up in this particular exhibition, which is just sort of a kind of look around at a few moments or in a few things that you're involved in.
I suppose, as an artist, I've kind of gone away from that idea of having exhibitions, because my work is very much out in community and very much based here on our farm, the Barnaway in North Kerry. And it's very much been about working, yeah, literally walking to farms, you know, going on bikes to farms all over Kerry, really, in the last couple of years. So my art and my work has been out in fields. It informs my work as well, because the fact that we live on a farm very close to the sea and are impacted by all the recent extreme weather events, like there's a lot of water on our land, I think that's the impetus that makes me never really be able to rest in terms of saying this is so important and this is so critical. So yes, we've planted 10,000 trees here on our land. We've just walked the fields there about an hour ago and just looked at all of the damage that was done by the last storm. And I feel like that is really, really important, because that is what gets me up making art as well, because I know how important it is. And I know there's many people might be listening to this and saying, I don't want to talk about climate change. I don't want to know about it. But it is the absolutely huge issue of our time, and it is an existential threat, and we do need to face it, and we do need to adapt to a future that is very different to the one that we grew up with.
Lisa Fingleton there in her exhibition, The Square Tomato, is at Shimsatira in Tralee until March. And What You Grow and Why is very much the concern of Olivia Lang's book, which this time Paddy Woodworth is taking down from the Naturalist bookshelf.
Our Naturalist bookshelf broadcasts were born in the first weeks of the COVID-19 pandemic, when Culturefile asked me to talk about the new fascination with nature being reported by many lockdown citizens. Olivia Lang's broad and deep exploration of horticulture and nature, The Garden Against Time, which we're taking down from the bookshelf this week, also has roots in those strange but sometimes beautiful springtime days and weeks of 2020. She writes that it was as if, during that becalmed and frightening season, plants had emerged into collective visibility, a source of succour and support. Amen to that. The contributions from our bookshelf have generally focused on nature less directly moulded by human intervention than happens in gardens. But Lang makes a dynamic, lyrical case for the scene the garden sets for encounters between humans and growing plants. They are, she says, as intimate, magical and sustaining as our wanderings into wilder places. She argues that gardening helps us to see the world in a different, enhanced manner. It is an education in looking, she says. It makes the ordinary world more intricate and finely detailed, as if I had acquired a magnifying glass that trebled the eye's capacity. It brings her a sense of soothing, grounding, beautifying. But her appreciation of these aspects is always qualified by awareness of the philosophical and political contradictions of gardens. The brief bliss of Eden was followed by the fall. And gardens remain to this day, in her view, sites of tension between private and public property. She never lets us forget that slavery provided the capital for a concerted beautification of the landscape, as the grotesque profits from sugar plantations were used to found lavish gardens back in England. She contrasts such gardens with the communalist Eden project, briefly attempted by the radical digger movement during the Cromwellian period. Plants were always spilling out from the centre of any utopia I imagined, she confesses, and she's attracted to utopias of all kinds. I loved the idea of a communal or remedial garden, she writes. The core of Lang's book is, nonetheless, her personal and private restoration of a modest but significant garden attached to her new home. It was designed by a previous owner, the distinguished horticulturalist Mark Roomery, who had Chelsea Flower Show medals to his credit. He had planted it in imaginative, though disciplined, detail. But it had largely gone wild, in inverted commas, by the time she and her partner bought it. And thus she can revel in the inherent dynamic of gardening on the threshold between artifice and nature, conscious decision and wild happenstance, a place where the wild was made domesticated and the domestic wild. If that garden is the book's core, it generates a flourishing outgrowth of literary, philosophical and political reflections as diverse as the species she plants or uproots. You will meet writers as varied as William Morris, Capability Brown and Andrew Marvel in these pages. She gives critical, detailed consideration to John Milton's portrayal of Eden in Paradise Lost. But she also focuses on the filmmaker Derek Jarman's contemporary creation of a semi-natural garden near Dungeness Nuclear Power Station, made while he was dying of AIDS. Jarman's quirky mix of exotic and locally growing native plants continually undid the distinction between cultivated and wild that a garden is meant to proclaim. Lang is painfully conscious of the environmental catastrophe that our general cultivation and management of the earth is bringing fast upon us. She wonders whether the engagement with the garden's contradictions can bring us into a different relationship with time, and indeed with death, as it moves us into a looped rather than linear sense of the passage of existence. A long, unwinding spiral of rot and fertility. But she is oppressed by our garden's time-honoured rhythms being crazily accelerated and then dried out by climate change. March had been like May, and May like midsummer. And so the ethical issue of watering during a drought arises. One of the most horrifying aspects of those weeks, she writes, was seeing the garden become another manifestation of selfishness, a private luxury at a public cost. She wants to see it as a place that runs counter to the world's more toxic drives, a refuge from its priorities, where other forms of life are given more regard. In my years on environmental protests, she continues, gardening had seemed the best, least damaging way to spend a life. But a garden is many things at once, as I'd begun to see. Selfish and selfless, open and enclosed. However, at the end, she returns to her own vision as the most powerful one. The common paradise, that heretical dream. Take it outside, she urges us, and shake the seed.
Paddy Woodworth there, and don't forget to encounter more of the books on the Naturalist Bookshelf. Check out the Culture File page on the RTE Lyric FM site. Now, do you like mushrooms, or do you really like mushrooms? The fresh focus on mushrooms, heralded by mycophile author Merlin Sheldrake and others, has spread into the restaurant world in the shape of a New York City restaurant called The Third Kingdom. There, the kitchen turns out an all-fungus menu, using not just traditional culinary mushrooms, but ingredients such as huita la coche, otherwise known as corn smut, a soft, spreadable fungus that grows randomly on corn cobs, widely enjoyed in Mexico. Follow that with a scoop of porcini ice cream or a candied shiitake crumble, and you're on your way to shroom heaven, as Culture File's Vanessa Noonan found out when she crossed over into the Third Kingdom.
My name is Drew Brady.
They're awesome.
We are at Third Kingdom, which is a restaurant in the East Village of New York City that focuses on mushrooms in every one of our dishes. In each dish, there's one mushroom that we highlight as like the star of the show. And then there's like a subsequent composition of other ingredients on the plate. But the way the menu is written, the title of each dish is the mushroom in focus. And there's about 8 to 12 dishes at any given time. I think what's really unique about the restaurant from the menu's perspective, besides solely showcasing mushrooms, is that we encourage guests to kind of build their own tasting. We ask them to select a variety of dishes and assure them that once we collect their selections, chef is going to kind of sort them out based on what they've ordered. Some dishes work really well on the heels of the next. So that's kind of as far as the strategy goes. And then they'll begin to come to the table in succession, and we'll tell them about each dish as they arrive. There's a mushroom on our menu now. It's a pretty common mushroom. It's called the beach mushroom. It's probably about the size of like the top part of your pinky. It's all white. It's very stereotypical mushroom looking, but we discovered that the texture of this mushroom almost is like macaroni if you cook it down to a certain degree. So we cook it down in a cauliflower cream sauce, do a little toasted breadcrumbs, and essentially what happens is it comes to you in a bowl and it's like mac and cheese, but all the noodles are cute mushrooms. There's no actual noodle.
You call yellow what?
Enoki.
Oh, yellow enoki. Yeah. Wow. beautiful. They're like little flowers.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I think there's probably three components in menu development. But I think nostalgia is one, specifically for this restaurant. Then there are regional influences, and then there's just the mushroom. Certain mushrooms just kind of like take us for a ride when we're recipe testing. Huilacoche is fascinating. It's a mushroom that was seen as a flaw for a lot of farmers because it grows on ears of corn. When corn experiences adverse weather conditions, some may feel like it ruins the corn, and others feel like it's producing a delicacy for others to eat. So, you know, working with that, you kind of have this whole pretext of knowing that it's a delicacy and trying to figure out ways to incorporate it in dishes that make sense, but also don't override the flavor of that mushroom. Our chef is from Puebla in Mexico. His name is Juan Pajarito. I think we were sort of gifted by chefs growing up in Mexico because he was able to very quickly put together a tasting menu for that mushroom. What's interesting about that mushroom is that it's incredibly difficult to find here in the States. So in Mexico, chef was telling me that like when this happens, it's shaved off the ear immediately. It goes right to the market. They'll do like quesadillas and stuff like that. But the time in between it comes off the ear to when it can go into your mouth is a very short period of time. So we got connected with a gentleman named Mushroom Mike, who's in Wisconsin, who has figured out a way to inoculate his own corn. He's a corn farmer, and get it to us super quickly. So the mushroom community, you know, we have a handful of restaurants here in the neighborhood. We're all plant-based restaurant group. So plant-based has grown in popularity in the dining scene, especially here in New York City over the last 10 or 15 years. In those early days, there was a fervor and we felt like we had a captured audience, right? People were like, we want to see what you're doing with vegetables. And there's a lot of excitement around that. I see a lot of similarities with the mushroom community. So you'll have like folks who eat meat who are just like super into mushrooms. There's like a science crowd who just loves coming to us. The artists, you know, just based on like how visually stunning and intricate mushrooms are to look at, how inspiring they can be to the creative process. So you get these little pockets of different people from different walks of life who just like exalt the idea of the mushroom. And it really makes for like really fun, dynamic dinner services. Like every night when we open the door, I feel like we're just like raising the curtain on the stage. And it's like, where are we going tonight? We have the New York City Mycology Society, which is like the cutest collection of individuals. And I don't want to like underscore the serious work they do by calling them cute, but it's their fault. They just are cute. One guest that is like a huge inspiration to me that I kind of like fumble around and try not to embarrass myself in front of is Eugenia Bone. She played a big role in the Fantastic Fungi documentary that like went super viral on, I think, Netflix. She comes once a month, maybe, you know, it feels like she's here all the time, but when she does come, it kind of like sears itself into my memory. Savory and sweet are two things that kind of hold hands together. We all know that. But yeah, we have a dessert right now that is a mushroom ice cream. And, you know, your biggest fear when you're kind of coming up with dishes that maybe sort of lean towards novelty more than others, you don't want to put concept over like the functionality of the flavor profile, which you see all the time. You're like, okay, that reads really cool on the menu, but like, this is confusing my mouth and it's not enjoyable. We got lucky. It's not to say that we will get lucky again, but we have a dessert on the menu that's just an excellent chocolate lava cake. A component on this dish that kind of knocks it out of the park is an ice cream that is a vanilla-based ice cream with porcini mushroom. It's stunning. Like, it is absolutely delicious. It enhances the flavor of the ice cream in a way that we didn't even anticipate. And then there's these rocky bits that are kind of garnishing on the dessert that are candied shiitake mushrooms. So we encourage guests to kind of like try one on their own before they dive into the dessert. And there's some dots of blueberry sauce as well. So those things come together and it's just divine. I think the earthiness of the porcini kind of creates like an anchor. You're really on the ground floor, like both metaphorically, you know, and as far as like the hierarchy of flavors. So it grounds the dish. And that makes sense for an earthy component to kind of give you that place to orient yourself from as you're trying the different components of the dessert. So like vanilla, and again, this is totally subjective. Vanilla to me is like a soaring sort of head in the clouds kind of flavor, right? And then when you return to that, that earthiness of the porcini in every other bite, it's just delightful.
Wow. It's sort of like a chestnut or a really Christmassy kind of.
I also get like breakfast cereal nostalgia. Like, yeah. You know, I don't know where that's coming from.
Vanessa Noonan there being led through the Third Kingdom, which is in the East Village, it turns out. Now, in the season ahead, you might notice some developments in Culture File, which we're hoping you'll enjoy. And one of those is called The Comfort Zone, which we'll visit every fortnight, and where we'll meet the novelist Colm Tobin. Each episode, Colm will join me to welcome a guest who'll tell us about a film, a book, a piece of music, or some other part of culture that they treasure and they think we should know about. Our first guest in the series will be the academic and influential author of Immediacy, Anna Kornblue, who's a champion of David Lynch. Mulholland Drive, and here's a taste of that conversation. Anna, so what is your history with David Lynch's work? I mean, did you ever come across him? Did you ever encounter him in bodily form?
Oh, I never did encounter him in bodily form, much though I admire the cloth and the quiet. But my history is that at a formative and adolescent moment, Twin Peaks was on TV, and my parents were kind of cool enough to know this is not usual TV. And so within the first couple weeks of it premiering, when I was, you know, a teenager, my parents started hosting parties on Thursday night to watch Twin Peaks because it was just like, what is this art going on? What is this weirdness going on? You can do that on TV, you know? And they had these Thursday night parties and we would stay up late and it was so weird. And so trying to integrate that as a teenager, you know, this kind of magic artist who really was trying to stretch the bounds of different media. But I never did meet him.
So that's a small taste of a comfort zone episode. But what exactly, Colm, is a comfort zone?
The comfort zone is anyone who goes to film or listens to music or reads books knows there are things that you just think are not, they're not part of my comfort zone. You know, in other words, if I had to listen to Taylor Swift, for example, or if I had to go to some horror film, would be a good example, out of my comfort zone. That's just not in my comfort zone. And so sometimes what you really want is to be in your comfort zone completely, it's called curling up with a book, you know, or watching some movie you adore, or putting on some piece of music, putting on, you know, Bizet's Carmen or something, and, you know, just loving it. But actually what you really need to do, especially when you get to my age, because I'm going to be 70 this year, is you need to be careful that you're not just doing, that your comfort zone is not diminishing each year as you become crankier and older. So the aim is, for example, something like David Lynch. And he died recently and everyone was talking about how wonderful he was. He's always been outside my comfort zone. And what I'm going to try and do now for this program is to see if I could in some way reconcile my prejudices with some actual serious thinking or just going back to look. Just making it, it's called making an effort. Sometimes I won't make an effort. I'll be straight, like Syracuse is completely in Sicily, is completely my comfort zone. It's a beautiful city. You know, what else is there?
So at least twice a month for the coming season, we'll be making an effort.
That's correct.
Colm Tobin there, and our first step into the comfort zone with Colm and Anna Kornblue on David Lynch's Mulholland Drive is next time on Culture File.